by hundreds of police officers who actually had sexual relations and babies with some of the people they were targeting. I mean, it's like East Germany, except people don't realise it.
So we're also joined on the line now by Larry Johnson. Larry, would you like to just introduce yourself by way of telling us a little bit about your career?
Yeah, my background, I spent 4 years with the Central Intelligence Agency, 1985 to 89. During that time, I was in what's known as the career trainee program for the first year, had full exposure to all aspects of the CIA, and then wound up as a senior analyst for Central America during the wars in Central America. I moved from CIA to State Department's Office of Counterterrorism, spent 4 years there. Left that office in 1993 and began the consulting business that I still have that business up and running. But the two things I focused on in that time frame was one, scripting terrorism exercises for U.S. military special operations forces, and then doing international financial investigations. One of the our clients was the European Union. We did an investigation on money laundering and tobacco companies, liquor companies. And under that investigation, as an example, Philip Morris made a settlement with the EU for $1.5 billion, which sounds like a lot of money. It is, but that turned out to be about a weak cash flow for Philip Morris. So, you know, they were like paying a speeding ticket. So I've got a background in intelligence, military affairs, and analysis. So I bring a pretty comprehensive view to things.
There's a few names popped into my mind, and you're talking about, you know, 1980s and the CIA. Is names like Philip Agee, John Stockwell, also the filmmaker Alan Frankovich, who was making films about the CIA at the time. Whilst you were within the Central Intelligence Agency, was there an awareness that there were people out there almost like spying on you?
Oh, yeah. I mean, you know, there were always, as long as you've got a bureaucratic organization, you're always at some point going to have whistleblowers and malcontents of some form or another. And just calling someone a malcontent is not intended to be a disparaging term. It's just, you know, people are not happy with the way things are. And, you know, so, but Stockwell and Agee, I was aware of them, but they really didn't figure much in what I was doing.
If you were to just meet someone at a bar or in a pub, how would you explain the role of the Central Intelligence Agency to them as a whole?
A meddlesome mother-in-law, you know, one that has all the bad vices and telling you to not indulge in them. You know, what the CIA was set up to do was to provide the president with some objective analysis. You know, when Harry Truman established the CIA, at that point you had newspapers that were very much under the ownership of strong individuals with very decided political views about things, and accordingly would shape the news. The only good news back then was that there was enough diversity and competition that you would, it was tough to manage the message. What Truman was looking for was something that would provide objective insight. And as part of that was to also have a system in place for gathering intelligence from overseas so that we'd absolutely know what the hell was going on in another country. That was the plan. But shortly after setting up the CIA, they decided that we ought to get involved in shaping affairs in other countries. And that gets into what's called covert action. And it's in the covert action field that the CIA really has been the most active over the years and the most destructive. You know, during, if I recall the number correctly, during the administration of Dwight Eisenhower, President Eisenhower, which was 8 years, from 1952 to 1960, or actually, you know, his term went from January of 53 until January of 61. There were over 170 covert actions carried out in 48 countries, and that included the overthrow of the government of Mossadegh in Iran in 1953, the overthrow of the government of Jacobo Arbenz in Guatemala in 1954, I believe it was. So a lot of meddling in the internal affairs of other countries. That became sort of the hallmark. And throughout that period, the United States was particularly aggressive in trying to foment a civil war in the then Soviet Union and using Ukraine as a springboard for that.
Well, yes, and Ukraine, of course, is coming very much into everyone's views. Do you want to just give us your own take on how we got to where we are? We're listening on the news, scratching our heads with incredulity to various commentators saying, oh, just go and use these long-range missiles. Ukraine can use them now to hit in as far as they want into Russia. And the Russians saying, oh, well, that means that this is now a war with NATO. It's not just a war with Ukraine. So how did we get to this point?
Because we have a generation of Alzheimer's patients. You know, people have no historical memory. They have short attention spans. They don't pay attention to, you know, world affairs. The West is angry with Vladimir Putin because he will not be our prison bitch. He will not submit to us and do what we want him to do, which is surrender Russia and turn over all the resources to the West. You know, he's a little cantankerous in that regard. So, you know, this really goes back to shortly after Putin took over from the wreckage of the collapse of the Soviet Union and then the government of Boris Yeltsin, which basically was selling off all of the resources and wealth of Russia to foreign oligarchs and creating a new class of Russian oligarchs. And, you know, a significant number of them were Jewish. You know, it's not hate speech to acknowledge that. It's just the reality. And I think it was 2001 that Putin convened a meeting at the Kremlin with these oligarchs. And he basically said, hey, this is going to be the deal going forward. You're going to stop selling off our country to these foreigners. If you insist on doing that, I'm going to put you in jail. But if you work on investing your money and resources here in Russia, I'll leave you alone and you can make money. You can continue to be wealthy. Most of them took the deal. Some, like Michael Khodorkovsky, didn't, and he wound up in prison. The second thing was Putin said, and you're not going to be involved with politics anymore. You're going to butt out. That started a revolution in Russia in which the society was literally transformed into a vibrant, thriving economy, one that was not full of oppression. It wasn't like the old Soviet days where people were literally in fear of being denounced and sent off to Siberia. It became a much more open society, but Putin actually delivered on making economic improvements to the lives of citizens.
I mean, wasn't Putin's challenge to these oligarchs, does it maybe have some resonance with what John F. Kennedy was planning to do in the 1960s with the, I mean, he was threatening particularly the CIA, but also the mob, saying, well, hang on a minute, guys, you know, okay, so our family has made our money through you, but we're now deciding that we're going to try and put our house in order. Is there any kind of similarity between the two attitudes of Putin in 2000 and 1961 John F. Kennedy?
No, because I don't think Kennedy was really keen on that big of a reform. But Putin was, and we, you know, again, you can see it All you have to do is walk into any of the subway stations, the metro, the underground in Moscow. It's like going into an art museum, and I mean an exquisite art museum. It's incredible. It's clean. It's efficient. The stores filled with goods. But throughout this period, the West had not given up on its desire to take control of Russia's vast natural resources, because Russia in the world is the number one. By I think the United States, number two, China, number three, Ukraine, who we talked about in our correspondence, is number five, four or five. But with the West was keen on taking control of Russia. And a part of that was to bring Ukraine into NATO. And Putin told the West very clearly in 2008, no. And that led the current CIA director, Bill Burns, who was then ambassador to Moscow, to write a cable. We call them cables, but it was a message sent electronically back, an email, if you will, to main states. And the Russian attitude is niet means niet, no means no. And yet, despite that clear marker that Putin put down, the West proceeded with provoking, encouraging, and backing Georgia to try to take territory inside Russia. That led to a brief war in August of 2008, and Russia crushed Georgia. And so this continued until 2014, when the U.S. and the United Kingdom, so the CIA and MI6 got together, organized a coup, overthrew the government in Kiev that had been democratically elected, and then installed a new pro-Western government. And that new pro-Western government then proceeded to launch a civil war against the Donbass. And what people don't understand is the Donbass, historically within the Soviet Union, within Russia, I saw a poster. I was in Moscow in February, and this poster was made up in 1927, and it shows the Donbass region, but it appears like a heart with arteries and veins running in and out of it. And the expression in Russian is Donbass, Serce Rossiya, Donbass, the heart of Russia. And it literally is a manufacturing, mining, mineral heart of Russia. It was really a core of its industrial capability. And when the Ukrainian government in Kiev decided to launch these ethnic attacks, and they were going to prohibit people from speaking Russian, even though that they grew up speaking Russian. I mean, hell, even Zelensky, he grew up speaking Russian. He didn't grow up speaking Ukrainian. So when that attack started, that's why Russia went in and they conducted the election in Crimea. And the Crimeans said, no, we don't want to be part of Ukraine. We want to go back to Mother Russia, which they did. And so this war that we're seeing now, it actually started in 2014. And, for 8 years until February of 2022, Ukraine, with the backing of the West, was conducting an attack on civilians and militias in Luhansk Republic and the Donetsk Republic. So that's what's brought us to this point, that finally Russia said enough, and they launched the counterattack to oust the Ukrainians, both what they called the demilitarization and denazification. Because understand, I think it's going back to 2007. Every year from up until 2022, so 15 years, the United States and other NATO allies were conducting annual military exercises inside Ukraine. Now, understand what I'm saying. conducting military exercises with the Ukrainians, where the enemy was always Russia. Now, can you imagine if, you know, let's say that Russia formed an alliance with the Scots and then decided to conduct annual military exercises in Scotland that were directed at England as the enemy? Do you think the Brits would stand for that? I don't. Similarly, in the United States, if Russia tried to do something like that with Mexico, we would use that as a casus belli. Well, for God's sake, we keep tweaking the damn bear, and then when we get the surprised when the bear wakes up and wants to eat us. So that's what's been going on, and that's what's brought us to this point.
And but, it's getting a bit more serious, Larry, isn't it? Because you know, we're now talking about when we saw 3 months ago the Ukrainians ostensibly with a bit of help from NATO taking out these early warning defense radars, taking out a command center, attacking an airfield in Russia. These are the sorts of strategic targets which the Russians argued are absolutely no use to the Ukrainians, but they most definitely are of use to NATO. So, for example, NATO might launch strategic nuclear weapons at Russia, and these radars would find those, but the Ukrainians don't have these to launch, so there's really no excuse. This is a NATO target. It's not a Ukrainian target, however much you wanted to argue it. And now we're talking about these long-range weapons, which have been supplied only apparently to be used within Ukraine, now to be used against Russia.
Well, yes. Let's be clear that those reports about the attacks on the radars, I think, were grossly exaggerated. They didn't really do any significant damage, but it was showing sort of an intent on the part of Ukraine, but with NATO's support. And yesterday, Vladimir Putin finally erased should have erased all doubt, because he came out very clearly and said, if NATO, if the United States or Britain or Germany, if they launch these strikes, if these missiles are launched and strike inside Russia, deep inside Russia, that it will be viewed by Russia as an act of war, and Russia will respond accordingly. Russia will attack British targets. Russia will attack American targets. Made that very clear, which I think is one of the reasons that after some reports out of Prime Minister Starmer's office initially indicating that they were going to green light Ukraine for launching these strikes, that the news that came out late last night was, on second thought, we're not going to do that. Because I think they realize now, you know, there's an acronym on the internet that stands FAFO. The cleaned up version is fool around, find out. The Russians gave a clear FAFO to both London and Washington that if they proceed with this, the response will be at them, not just at Ukraine. Now, I think while Russia is capable of escalating to using tactical nukes, I think they have some other options. One of the first things they could do is destroy the satellite system that the West is using to target, to collect and provide targeting data to Ukraine.
And to these Western missiles. Let's just look at what Putin actually said yesterday. The article on antiwar.com is supporting long-range strikes on Russian territory would put NATO at war with Russia, quoting Putin, at war with Russia. Putin said on Thursday warnings against the US for allowing Ukraine to use NATO missiles in long-range strikes inside Russian territory, saying the move would put the Western military alliance at war with Russia. Yep. The comments came after Politico reported the White House was finalizing plans to expand the areas inside Russia where Ukraine can use US and British provided missiles. This would, says Putin, in a significant way change the very nature of the conflict. It would mean that NATO countries, the US, European countries, are at war with Russia. If that's the case, then taking into account the change of nature of the conflict, we will take the appropriate decisions based on the threats that we will face. He added that supporting long-range Ukrainian strikes inside Russian territory is a decision on whether NATO countries are directly involved in the military conflict or not. So this is pretty clear. So, you know, one of the things, you did a post on your blog, which I think, isn't it called sonar21.com, or maybe you're a contributor.
Sonar21.com, that's me.
Which really piqued my interest, because you rather sarcastically say, well, we all know that Ukraine is one of the poorest nations in Europe, or the poorest nation, and what it, you know, it certainly looks like it now with so much devastation in the east. But then you point out, actually, this is completely wrong. And this is what I love about analysts actually pulling out the facts, where, you know, the TV pictures might give you one impression. The fact is nothing like that, is it? Ukraine, you say, is not one of the worst off countries actually at all. And you run through some of the resources that there are in Ukraine. You say it's the first in Europe in proven recoverable uranium ore. It's the second in Europe and the 10th in the world in titanium ore reserves. It's the second in the world in terms of manganese ore, and has roughly 12% of the world's reserves. It's the second in iron ore reserves in the world. It's got around about 30 billion tons. The second in Europe in mercury. The third in Europe in terms of shale gas reserves. The fourth place in the world in terms of the total value of natural resources. I mean, this place is an absolute mine, should we say, for Western corporations. So, but it might look poor right now, but I mean, and it's also known as a breadbasket, isn't it? So are there any of the this list that you've put up, which I'll share with our listeners on our show page at thisweek.org.uk, any of those statistics and particular resources that you think the West has got its beady eyes on?
All of them. I mean, why do you think BlackRock has poured more than $1 billion into investments to own Ukraine? Why do you think the West is so obsessed with Ukraine? You look at Russia and Ukraine side by side. One thing they share in common is both are resource-rich countries. And then when you realize that if you take Ukraine and fold it into Russia, there's no other country in the world that can match then that resource potential. And yet the different paths of development that have followed. Go to Russia today if you can. Go to Moscow. Go to St. Petersburg. The cities are modern. They're clean. The restaurants are superb. The stores are just filled with options and choices. It's a very, in terms of purchasing power parity, they measure gross domestic product according to what your dollars will buy you, what your currency will buy you. Russia is in the top five. It's better than Germany. It's better than the United Kingdom. It's better than France. It's better than any country in Europe. It's quite wealthy. And compare that with Ukraine, which is considered the poorest country in Europe. How the hell is that possible? Because Ukraine, with all of this wealth, both in minerals, in metals, in agriculture, in natural and energy, it's not just in one area. It's across the board. They should be one of the wealthiest countries in the world, and they're not, because they've been used. They're basically the equivalent of a rape victim. They've been raped by the West, by the colonial powers, by the Brits,
before 2014, Larry, surely the West wasn't able to. This was a East-leaning, Russian-leaning country.
Oh, no, no, no. Remember, starting in 1948, 49, the CIA and British MI6 were actively involved in Ukraine, both recruiting and training insurgencies and guerrillas. So the United States and the Brits, they worked hand in glove on using Ukraine as a springboard to go against Russia itself. With the collapse in 1991, that just accelerated because the number of Western oligarchs that got their claws and hooks into Ukraine was just off the charts. I did a job with the Central Intelligence Agency back in 1994, where I accompanied a female CIA contractor. So the CIA at that point was it was a project where they were claiming that they were setting up business centers. So it was a commercial cover operation. They were setting up business centers, but the purpose of those business centers was to try to identify families, individuals that had ties into the former KGB. But as part of that trip, when I was there, we got to visit a former factory. It turned out they made SS-21 warheads at this factory. And what they had done was they had literally transformed some of the equipment into a pizza oven, and were building a pizza oven. And so it was a time of great upheaval, and the soldiers that were walking around the streets, and again, this was 30 years ago. The soldiers walking around the streets were in threadbare uniforms, and the boots they had on looked like they'd been overused. Ukraine was suffering. They had a very active black market for just buying something as simple as gasoline. I remember the fellow that was driving me around, he looked like a walking human refrigerator. He was former Spetsnaz. And one morning we were taking the circuitous route. And I was worried that he was going to take me under a bridge and dispose of me. But it turned out that he was looking for gas. And it was all the gas being sold on the black market. So, that was Ukraine back then. But then, the level of corruption, what's going on there today, is just off the charts. And unlike Russia, I don't want to hear anybody in Britain or the United States talk about corruption in these other countries, because good God, look at Hunter Biden and Joe Biden. They come back and talk to me about corruption. I mean, the United States is just as bad, just as guilty as some of these other places, but we like to get all sanctimonious and you sit on our moral high horse and criticize them. But what we have seen in Russia over the last 3 months, a lot of senior military guys have been arrested and are facing charges on corruption because they were profiting off of the war and taking advantage of the troops. At least, I haven't seen too many going to jail here in the United States or in Ukraine.
Larry, it's brilliant you taking us back to the 1990s, because this was such a fascinating period in the Eastern Bloc, the old Warsaw Pact area. Now, our own journalist, originally a New Zealander, Roger Cook, working for the BBC and then Central Television, he went out there and he made a program called Dirty Bomb, where he was doing undercover filming. It was a journalistic sting, in order to get information, in fact, to get hold of weapons-grade plutonium from in Moscow, from these people who were connected with the military and hadn't been paid for months. And they were just looking to dispose of anything that they could get, that they had their hands on, including, and he did get hold of weapons-grade plutonium, which was then tested. But just as he was about to leave Moscow, they said to him, well, why don't you just, why can't we just sell you one of these SS-20 systems? Because, you don't have to make it into a bomb. This is all ready to go. And they lifted up the tarpaulin, and there was an SS-20 launcher with warheads. I mean, this does make you think that maybe this whole idea of weapons, nuclear weapons out there on the black market, was much bigger in the 90s than we realized.
Yeah. Well, in fact, that was what was, when we went to that one building to look at what we were told was going to be a pizza oven, and the building itself reminded me of the U.S. main State Department building. And you walked into this, hallway, entry hallway, and then as we went down a corridor, and, the corridor was probably 100, 200 meters long. And as you're walking along, you could smell the toilets, which was sort of an odd, sensation. But also about every 20 meters or so, there was a grate. A metal grate in the floor, and we'd walk over that and I wonder, huh? And so when we came into this room, you could literally smell the heat coming off of the oven. I mean, it was heated up. And then I looked around the room, and there are what are called radioactive glove boxes. So, if anybody's seen a premature baby in a nursery, they have these, they're in this plastic shell, and people can put their arms in through gloves and So these were boxes for handling radioactive material, and it had the radioactive sign on the side of it. I'm going, good Lord, what have we gotten ourselves into? And then they proceeded to show us this pizza oven, and it had a massive electronics box, or a box on the side to contain electronic, all the components. But and I'd say it was probably 1 meter by 2 meters in size. So it's fairly, fairly large, and or one by 1.5 meters. And but when you opened it up, the electronic components that were running this pizza oven were just up in one corner. What they were doing was cannibalizing everything they had. And I did ask him, I said, well, what did you guys make here before this? And the answer was SS-21 warhead. So, there was these people were facing economic survival. I mean, it was literally they were struggling to figure out how to stay afloat. And when you get people into that kind of desperate situation, they'll do anything.
Martin Summers, I hope you're still with us. Martin, you were actually also out in Eastern Europe, I know, weren't you? Doing work, looking at the potential for a kind of Western style, the economy, the economy was in a terrible state, and that's so. Martin, can you just say what your experience was of Eastern Europe? And I think were you in Poland? And
well, I originally started working in Eastern Europe in 1991. For the New Economics Foundation. So I've been teaching economics, and then of course the Berlin Wall came down, things changed, and I applied to be the East European desk officer for the New Economics Foundation, which is sort of left of centre green.
I mean, did you see any evidence of the sort of activity Larry's describing there with these Western intelligence services looking around and seeing, right, okay, let's just start cataloguing all of this, and hopefully the West can take it over?
Well, I mean, the whole economic reform was very badly conceived. As Larry Johnson, I follow your blog closely, Larry, by the way, so it's great to have you on here.
Oh, thanks so much.
Yeah, I mean, you're one of the people I read every day. You will know Jeffrey Sachs, who was at the time, he was a much more senior person than I was. I was very, very lowly. I was just trying to get in the game, really, on behalf of my employers, going to conferences, trying to find out what was going on. He was obviously much more senior. He advised the Polish government, and then he advised the Russian government on the economic reform. But, of course, he's come out very in recent years and recent times saying how badly conceived it all was. How it was just stupid, a lot of what went down. And of course, what was actually happening in Russia was that and in Ukraine was a sort of meltdown of industrial society. So lots of lots of, you know, critical infrastructure, was like railway lines and electricity pylons, was being was being totted out, as we call it in England, and then sold off as scrap through the Baltic states.
And I mean, you could, Martin, look at the United States and Britain and say, well, actually, we've been deindustrialized. You've got these massive private equity firms taking over that. What the Russians did is we're saying we're not going to have that happen here.
Well, what happened was they actually did the transition shock in the Soviet Union proper was far worse than anything we saw here or in the US. I mean, it's pretty bad in both countries, but it was a grinder process, you know, the miners strike here and so on and so forth. It was all done overnight there, and it was totally misconceived. I mean, I did actually argue this at the time, and I wrote a book with a Hungarian economist about this, which came out in 1998. He went on to be Laszlo Andor, he went on to be a European commissioner. But I mean, basically, the whole thing was misconceived. And I remember talking to someone from the British government at the time when I was back in London. I said, well, why are they doing this? Is it because they believe all this free market nonsense? Or is it because they're trying to destroy the Russians as a potential military threat? And he said, it's both of those things and something you haven't mentioned. Some people are making an awful lot of money out of this. And that was the whole process was very destructive. But as Larry pointed out, the Russians managed to pull the plane out of the dive, and they've moved, and you can see the difference in Ukraine and Russia today. Ukraine carried on following the same old silly policies, and they've ended up where they've ended up. Russia decided to change its direction, and they've very successful.
Yeah, it's interesting, isn't it? You've also got next door to Ukraine, Martin, you've got Belarus, which has taken a different path, a more eastern-leaning Russian path. Right, well, getting back to Larry's blog, you talk a lot about the agriculture, which is very close to my heart, Larry. The first in Europe in terms of arable land area, the biggest. That is, you know, obviously there are other countries, a lot of them are mountainous. They are not. They have a massive arable land area. The third place in the world by area Chernozem? What does that mean?
Chernozem.
Yeah, I'm not sure what that means. I saw that and I was like, it may have just
been that's a mystery.
Title.
We'll have to figure out later. First in the world for export of sunflower and sunflower oil, second for barley production, fourth in the world for barley export, third largest producer and fourth largest exporter of corn in the entire world, the fourth largest potato producer, the fifth largest rye producer. I'm not even sure that we produce rye much in Britain at all anymore. Honey production, fifth in the world, eighth for wheat exports. I mean, they are quite well known, aren't they, Larry, for wheat, particularly in grain, and seen as a massive export market.
Yeah, this was so. These numbers are pre-February 2022, because since particularly with the war raging in the Donbass, I wouldn't want to be a farmer out in the fields trying to plow, because good Lord knows what you're going to plow up in terms of a mine or getting hit with a drone or facing a bomb coming in. But there's no denying that there are some countries that are known for only, like Saudi Arabia. Well, Saudi Arabia is not producing potatoes and corn. All right, they do oil. That's it. Similarly, like even Venezuela, Nigeria. So you get these countries that are known for being oil producers. Well, here you have Ukraine, which is, they do it all. They do it on the agriculture side. They do it with metals. They do it with minerals. They do it with energy. And so by any definition, they should be one of the wealthiest, most productive countries. It would make sense to bet on them from an economic standpoint. But this is where we get to these power relationships. Who actually controls? Who's making the decisions? And are those decisions being made in the best interest of their citizens? And you look at what's happening, right now in the United Kingdom and in the United States. Both countries, when you go back to World War II, had an industrial base that was able to operate and played an important role. The industrial base in the United States was far grander in scale than anything in the UK. But back then, the UK was still pretty robust in its ability to produce steel, for example. But now, over the course of the last 30 years, those industrial capabilities have been stripped. And when you're stripping those industrial capabilities, you're taking jobs away from people who are really, I call it the backbone of those societies. I look back in my own life. So, I graduated from high school 50 years ago. And when I graduated, my father was a machinist foreman at Armco Steel, previously known as Sheffield Steel. One of my other classmates, his father was a production foreman at Standard Oil Corporation. They had a Standard Oil refinery there in the Independence, Missouri, Sugar Creek, Missouri area. Others' parents worked at Bendix Corporation. Others at Alice Chalmers, where they produced farm implements. Others at Leeds plant for General Motors, where they produced automobiles. When I went back for the 50th high school reunion, none of those plants were there operating. So the point is that when you have that kind of wealth that can be generated for workers, back then, I wasn't from a wealthy family, but, my dad could afford a new car every 2 or 3 years. We could take a family vacation. We had a modest home, but there was enough money to sustain a stable, solid middle class. Well, that's not what's happening now in the United States. That's not what's happening in the UK. And you see this growing gap between those who are, let's call it the worker class, and those who are the financial class. Enormous gaps. It's beginning to mirror and look like Ukraine. And that's not a good look.
Well, so what is in it for us? I'm talking about us as citizens of the United Kingdom, subjects, and of the United States. What's in it for us, this war? I mean, I can't imagine great queues of people wanting out to go and join the army and fight Russia.
Well, I tell you what's in it for you. As long as you're a shareholder, as long as you hold stock in Lockheed Martin, General Dynamics, or Raytheon Corporation, then you are doing just fine, because those stocks have for example, Northrop Grumman, its stock back in January of 2022 was about $270. Now it's over $520. Okay? So this is about making money for these corporations. And those who hold stock in those corporations making out like bandits, laughing all the way to the bank.
So, I mean, what you're saying is simply, in a nutshell, is that the shift over the last 20, 30 years has been away from manufacturing for peace to manufacturing for war in the West.
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. The military-industrial complex, when you look at the history of the United States in this regard, we've been at war almost continuously since 1956, 57, when we started, 50. We go to war in Korea, come out of Korea, then we get embroiled in Vietnam, and then Vietnam goes off the rails, but we continue, then we get involved with Central America, and then we're involved with Africa, and then, so it goes on and on. We keep looking for a new enemy. And all the time, with the collapse of the Soviet Union, at that point, we should have said, hey, we've won the Cold War. We no longer have to worry about a Soviet threat, a Soviet international communism taking over the planet. We were already in a diplomatic relationship with China, so we didn't have to worry about the Chinese conquering anything. And so at that point, we could have cut our defense spending and redirected that defense spending to building up infrastructure, making sure that every child was properly educated. But instead, we decided, oh, we struggled for a few years trying to figure out a new enemy, and then we found terrorism. And so the global war on terror became, you know, the driving incentive, and the defense budget continued to grow and creep up. And now once the war on terror has sort of petered out, it's back to it's Russia, it's China, it's Iran. Russia, China, it's Iran, oh my, you know, lions, tigers, and bears. And that becomes the driving force to justify now U.S. defense budget's approaching $900 billion. And some argue that, in fact, if you go through the actual expenses, it's probably closer to $1.2 trillion. Enormous amount of money. That's six times what Russia and China spend together on their defense needs. So this is all about corruption in the United States. I don't know if you've spent any time over the last 30 years in Washington, D.C. I first moved there in 1979, so 45 years ago. And when my wife and I first moved there, we lived in Chevy Chase, Maryland, near the National Institutes of Health. And at that time, you didn't have these McMansions. You know, the property was not selling for millions of dollars there in downtown Bethesda and Chevy Chase. You didn't have Lamborghini dealerships, Bentley dealerships, Ferrari dealerships. That was considered some strange European thing. The upscale automobile, if you got one, was Mercedes-Benz. Now today, you go to Washington, D.C., the money is washing over that like the tsunami did over Thailand back when it got flooded. It is, you've got Lamborghini, Rolls-Royce. They got Rolls-Royce dealerships there. Bentleys as well. The Bugatti. You got cars that are, you go purchase a car for $300,000-$400,000. You've got the property is off the charts. Well, what's changed? Washington, D.C. doesn't produce anything. It's not like there are factories out there. What it sells is influence, access to power, and this ability to cut sweetheart deals and take control of resources of foreign countries. Yeah. And so here is this, you know, this sick, I'll call it a sick imperialist policy on the part of the West. And it's coming unraveled right now, because at the very time that we're dependent upon being able to essentially rape other countries, those other countries are standing up together and saying, no. This program of systematic rape is going to stop. And that's why you've got BRICS. And that's why you've got nations around the global South lining up to say, hey, we're going with them. And they're telling the United States and Britain to sod off.
At the end of the day, though, of course, the NATO countries aren't going to have that. They're going to say, well, we're going to have to hang on. I'm just looking at a Bloomberg article this week. Morgan Stanley sees the euro sliding 7% on the risk of big European Central Bank cuts. Morgan Stanley is saying that the euro could slide towards parity with the dollar within just a couple of months on the risk markets are moving to price in more aggressive policy easing, whatever that means, by the European Central Bank to tackling a faltering economy. So it does seem as if, over the last couple of years, for whatever reason, Europe has not really been able to manage its economy successfully, and we're having to buy from Europe a lot of our stuff from the States, not least of which, of course, is energy, Larry.
Yeah. Well, that was part of the reason the United States blew up Nord Stream pipeline. You know, we wanted to become the sole supplier of your cocaine, or I mean natural gas. But, you know, as long as Russia was there able to supply natural gas to Germany and to the rest of Europe at a very low cost, because there were not huge transportation costs built in, it made it difficult for the United States to compete. Well, we can't have that. You know, United States is, if we can't win it by merit, well, by God, we're gonna get the fix in. And, you know, it's just like how the mob acts They tell you to pay the protection money. If you don't pay the protection money, we're going to come set your pizzeria on fire. And next time, maybe you'll pay the protection money. So, you know, that's what's going on. And, you know, the real irony of all of this is that the more, you know, what sapped the British Empire was its constant involvement in foreign wars. And World War One was really what sort of gutted the ability of the UK to maintain its empire status. World War Two was sort of the icing on the cake of saying, okay, hey, that colonial era is over. You still got the trappings. You can still dress up in the costumes, but in terms of actually having the clout, the military clout to make something happen, that's gone. You know, if you back in the, was it 54, when the Brits got together with the Israelis and decided to take over the Suez Canal, and Dwight Eisenhower told everybody, hey, you know, back in your lane, get back in, you know, climb back into your box, and everybody obeyed because, you know, none were powerful enough to resist the United States back then.
No. Well, anyway, look, let's go back up to now and looking towards this U.S. presidential election, Larry, because we've got a clip to play. And so this is from the debate this week. It's around about 5 minutes, but it's both of the candidates, Harris and Trump, giving their opinions on Ukraine. So, yeah, we've got a sort of section today where we're looking at the USA and the presidential debate. And this is, we're going to be hearing the first one, which is from Gaza, later. But as you're on, I think it'd be useful to have a listen to the two candidates discussing Ukraine now.
I want to turn to the war in Ukraine, into this conflict. Mr. President, it has been the position of the Biden administration that we must defend Ukraine from Russia, from Vladimir Putin, to defend their sovereignty, their democracy, that it's in America's best interest to do so, arguing that if Putin wins, he may be emboldened to move even further into other countries. You have said you would solve this war in 24 hours. You said so just before the break tonight. How exactly would you do that? A very simple question tonight. Do you want Ukraine to win this war?
I want the war to stop. I want to save lives that are being uselessly, people being millions. It's the millions. It's so much worse than the numbers that you're getting, which are fake numbers. Look, we're in for $250 billion or more because they don't ask Europe, which is a much bigger beneficiary to getting this thing done than we are. We're in for $150 billion less. And you don't have the courage to ask Europe like I did with NATO. They paid billions and billions, hundreds of billions of dollars when I said, either you pay up or we're not going to protect you anymore. So that's maybe one of the reasons they don't like me as much as they like weak people. But you take a look at what's happening. We're in for $250 to $275 billion. They're into $100 to $150. They should be forced to equalize. With that being said, I want to get the war settled. I know Zelensky very well, and I know Putin very well. I have a good relationship, and they respect your president, okay? They respect me. They don't respect Biden. How would you respect him? Why? For what reason? He hasn't even made a phone call in 2 years to Putin, hasn't spoken to anybody. They don't even try and get it. That is a war that's dying to be settled. I will get it settled before I even become president. If I win, when I'm president-elect, and what I'll do is I'll speak to one, I'll speak to the other, I'll get them together. That war would have never happened. And in fact, when I saw Putin after I left, unfortunately left because our country has gone to hell. But after I left, when I saw him building up soldiers, he did it after I left. I said, oh, he must be negotiating. It must be a good, strong point of negotiation. Well, it wasn't, because Biden had no idea how to talk to him. He had no idea how to stop it. And now you have millions of people dead, and it's only getting worse, and it could lead to World War III. Don't kid yourself, David. We're playing with World War III, and we have a president that we don't even know if he's – where is our president? We don't even know if he's a president.
And just to clarify
they
here –
they threw him out of a campaign like a dog. We don't even know – is he our president? But we have a president,
Mr. President,
that doesn't know he's alive.
Your time is up. Just to clarify in the question, Do you believe it's in the U.S. best interest for Ukraine to win this war, yes or no?
I think it's the U.S. best interest to get this war finished and just get it done.
All right.
Negotiate a deal, because we have to stop all of these human lives from being destroyed.
I want to take this to Vice President Harris. I want to get your thoughts on support for Ukraine in this moment, but also as commander-in-chief, if elected, how would you deal with Vladimir Putin, and would it be any different from what we're seeing from President Biden?
Well, first of all, it's important to remind the former president, you're not running against Joe Biden, you're running against me. I believe the reason that Donald Trump says that this war would be over within 24 hours is because he would just give it up. And that's not who we are as Americans. Let's understand what happened here. I actually met with Zelensky a few days before Russia invaded, tried through force to change territorial boundaries, to defy one of the most important international rules and norms, which is the importance of sovereignty and territorial integrity. And I met with President Zelensky. I shared with him American intelligence about how he could defend himself. Days later, I went to NATO's eastern flank, to Poland and Romania. And through the work that I and others did, we brought 50 countries together to support Ukraine in its righteous defense. And because of our support, because of the air defense, the ammunition, the artillery, the javelins, the Abrams tanks that we have provided, Ukraine stands as an independent and free country. If Donald Trump were president, Putin would be sitting in Kyiv right now. And understand what that would mean, because Putin's agenda is not just about Ukraine. Understand why the European allies and our NATO allies are so thankful that you are no longer president, and that we understand the importance of the greatest military alliance the world has ever known, which is NATO, and what we have done to preserve the ability of Zelensky and the Ukrainians to fight for their independence. Otherwise, Putin would be sitting in Kyiv with his eyes on the rest of Europe, starting with Poland. And why don't you tell the 800,000 Polish Americans right here in Pennsylvania how quickly you would give up for the sake of favor and what you think is a friendship with what is known to be a dictator who would eat you for lunch?
Well, there you go. Two contenders to be the emperor at the end of this year. Larry.
Yes.
Well, what do you make of the obvious thing is, who's going to win?
Well, if it's a fair contest, Trump's going to win. It depends what level of cheating there is and fraud. And whether or not the Republicans will get their act together to prevent that. What you're hearing from Kamala Harris is she's not making the decision. She's just going to be following orders, just like Joe Biden has been. This is all a grift. This is all about making money. And the only thing that they can argue is that any attempt that Trump makes to try to get the war settled and stopped is going to lead to accusations that he is the boyfriend, the romantic interest of Vladimir Putin, that he's in Putin's pocket, that he's under Putin's control. And see, that's one of the things that's so damn dangerous right now in this country, that none of the major political figures can stand up and be given, they will not be given a platform to make the case that Russia is not our enemy, that this narrative about Ukraine fighting for its freedom is just complete bullshit, that the reality is what we're witnessing is a failed U.S.-NATO attempt to try to conquer Russia and take control of Russia's resources in the same way that BlackRock is teed up to take control of Ukraine's resources. That's what this is all about. You know, what fascinates me is if you listen to the number of commentators about, they got to get rid of Vladimir Putin. Putin's got to go. We want to weaken Putin. Putin's got to go. I go, okay, well, if Putin goes, then what? You think somebody weak and malleable and under control of the West is going to be allowed to take control in Russia? Think again. Putin is the adult in the room who recognizes the danger of plunging this contest, getting plunged into a global war. Now, nobody wants to say this or hear this, but here are the facts. Russia has a robust anti-ballistic missile defense capability. Russia has the ability to shoot down U.S., British, French ballistic missiles if launched at Russia. By contrast, neither the French, the Brits, or the Americans have any anti-ballistic missile defense. Zero. And the reality is Russia could fight and win a nuclear war. People don't like to go there, but that's the reality. Would Russia suffer some damage? Oh, probably. But nothing that would devastate and destroy it as a country. The West, though, would be destroyed. And that's in the back of, that's in the back of Putin's mind in all of this. That's the very last place he wants to go. But
I mean, is it in the back of minds, Larry, is it in the back of the minds of the military that we in Britain and the United States trust to protect us?
Oh, hell no. No, they're still indulging in these fantasies. I mean, you listen to the number of, it's like a contest to see who can demonstrate the most ignorance between former British military officers and former American senior general officers. You know, we've got David Petraeus and Ben Hodges and General Jack Keane. You know, they all indulge this fantasy that Ukraine's got some robust, enormous military capabilities that they simply don't have. And all the while dismissing Russia as some sort of backward, awkward, incompetent group of fools. And yet we've got a bunch of data points we can look at. When the Soviets withdrew from Afghanistan in 1988, they did so over about an 8-month period starting in February. They withdrew. They didn't have any mass casualty events. They got out of the country on amicable terms. The government they left behind in charge lasted for 3 years. Compare that with the United States, which in August of 2021, it looked like a reprise of the escape from Saigon in, April of 1975. A complete collapse of the government and casualties and chaos. So, the Western military, whether we're talking the United States or British, is a joke. I mean, hell, the Brits can't even get an aircraft carrier out of harbor without it breaking down these days.
That's right. So, no, that's quite true. Look, let's just talk finally about the election coming up. I mean, it's pretty clear on Ukraine anyway. Trump just wants to get a deal struck, which would be a ceasefire and then some kind of line along where the line of combat now is between Russia and Ukraine. And finish it. And Harris wants to carry it on. That's pretty clear. Yeah. But it turns out that there's something called the Transatlantic Commission on Election Integrity, which is designed to check all of these elections, make sure they're all fine. But anyway, these are an unelected bunch, including the former Secretary General of NATO and a guy called Viktor Pinchuk, who was a key individual in the Ukraine coup. So I'll put a link up to them. I mean, we were hearing... from Mike Benz last week about this organization, fascinating bunch, the TCEI, which are supposed to safeguard our elections, are actually run by ex-intelligence people and ex-NATO heads and oligarchs. So that's obviously not going to quite, your elections won't be have much integrity with these guys around. But more importantly, Larry, something about worries me about election fixing. There's a great article NBC News came out with recently about online vulnerabilities. Experts finding nearly 36 US voting systems, not just individual voting machines, whole systems are actually connected to the internet, even though the researchers were told that none of them connected to the internet. When they had a very close look, they found actually they were.
Yeah, well, I mean, look.
I mean, this obviously, you know, there could be hacking going on during the election. Isn't it a good idea to just go over to the old-fashioned paper ballot?
Yeah, we should. We're Zimbabwe, you know. Actually, Zimbabwe makes us looks good compared to what we do in terms of how we run elections in this country. You know, the United States would give a banana republic a bad name. It's absurd to be caught in a situation where the opportunity for fraudulent votes is endemic to the system. And it is unlikely to be fixed by November. What I think is there is the possibility of this conflict widening, breaking out into war with Russia, or the United States get embroiled in a war in the Middle East with Iran and or Hezbollah, or even less likely but still on the table of possibilities is war with China. In either of those scenarios, what's going to happen is the United States is going to face a pretty rapid defeat, because there is no depth anymore to the U.S. capabilities. Look at the Houthis. The Houthis defeated the U.S. Navy. We deployed a carrier task force group to the Red Sea. We were going to bomb those Houthis into submission, to reopen the Red Sea route and make it freedom of navigation. And what happened? We had to ultimately pull the carrier task force group out because, well, they couldn't sustain. They couldn't stay in operation there. They needed to go refit, refuel, get a new crew. So they had to sell away, and the Houthis are still running the show. So if the mighty United States Navy with its British and German and French allies can't defeat the Houthis, in what world of fantasy do you believe that you could take on the Russians and or the Chinese or both at the same time? I mean, good Lord.
Okay, but hang on. Yeah, I mean, let me just put a scenario for November to you. Say Kamala Harris wins by a very thin margin, and millions of Republicans then say, well, hang on, you've just cheated at this election. And maybe they may actually have the evidence for it too. I mean, isn't this going to, you know, be perfect in a way for the deep state? Because they will say, well, you know, Harris has won. I'm very sorry, but anyone that protests against it is going to jail.
Yeah, yeah. No, hey, we've become the Soviet Union. The United States made its bones by being a revolutionary society and breaking away from the rule of Great Britain starting in 1776, has now become the very thing that we rebelled against. And we're behaving and imposing the same kind of Stalinist policies that we saw rife during the Soviet Union, during the bad old days of the Cold War. So, yeah, there is no moral consistency on this side of the ocean, and it's all about running this program of demonization against Donald Trump. But let me be clear, you know, I'm not arguing that Donald Trump's a great thinker or a great leader. You know, he's a very flawed individual. But the one thing to his advantage, he's not corrupt. He doesn't need to come to Washington, D.C. to get on the gravy train and start feeding at the trough. He's the one that actually got poorer by coming to D.C., unlike Bill Clinton, unlike George W. Bush, unlike Barack Obama, unlike Joe Biden. You know, it goes on, unlike Dick Cheney. I mean, you know, go down the list of this house of incest that is the Washington, D.C. But Trump at least understands that there is something called an interest in putting America first. And that starts with getting us out of these forever wars. But unfortunately, I think if Harris and her team gets in, the United States is going to destroy itself. And we'll take Great Britain and the rest of Europe down with us.
So your blog is called sonar21.com. But I'm sorry, I can't resist but I ask you, Larry, about this week. Germany, France and the UK have been imposing sanctions on Iran because Iran is trading with Russia. Now, of course, there are many people who are calling for sanctions on Israel, aren't there, for the genocide?
Yeah. Well, look, the reality is, if you look at the history of sanctions, I'm not aware of I guess there's only one case we can point to where sanctions appeared to be effective in forcing a change in government policy, and those were the sanctions imposed on South Africa for its apartheid policies. Apart from that, economic sanctions alone change people's economic incentives. And what we've seen as a result of the sanctions that were enforced on Russia has been led to the strengthening of BRICS and a dramatic move away from the U.S. dollar as a reserve currency. It's really changing the international economic order before our eyes. We're seeing some pretty dramatic moves in that regard.
Okay, Larry Johnson, sonar21.com. Thanks ever so much for joining us.
Hey, thank you, Tony. I appreciate the opportunity to chat with you and your audience.